good afternoon. One of my privileges, and thank God it's a fairly frequent privilege at Lincoln Square, is to be able to introduce Rabbi Brander from time to time. Rabbi Brander, I know there's a tremendous energy level that's being injected into the shul because of the Center for Jewish Future, Yeshiva University, Lincoln Square, Kollel, that's happening this year. Rabbi Brander, for those of you who do not know, had his first major rabbinic position here at Lincoln Square Synagogue. So it was one of us before it was one of you, if I can say. But I wanted to just say two things. First of all, I want to say to Rabbi Brander, on behalf of Lincoln Square, thank you for this program, which is just terrific and tremendous, and the women who are participating in the program are tremendous. And I want to say what a privilege it is to have Rabbi Brander here speaking and addressing us this morning, or this afternoon now. And without further ado, the Dean of the Center for Jewish Future, Rabbi Kenneth Brander.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to share words of Torah with you. Bershut Tamar Da'atra, Rabbi Robinson, and in special thanks to Daphna for helping to choreograph this entire program. It's really a special privilege anytime you teach Torah, but especially in a place like this. The last time I spoke here actually was just a few months ago. The last time I spoke before that here was probably around 20 years ago. And this really for me was a wonderful incubator with a mentor of mine, Rabbi Berman, who gave me real special wings and the opportunity really to think creatively. And I have a tremendous amount of hakaras hatov, of recognition to the synagogue for what it did for me personally and for how it inspired me to hopefully be an effective communicator of Torah and to recognize that there are multiple portals of entry through which we should be engaged in inspiring Jews to grow in their relationships to God. So it's I always feel a little emotional when I share words of Torah here. I actually remember davening in this minyan Shacharis one time, and it was literally my we moved here when we were in Sheva Brachos during our right after we got married, and I remember just the warmth and the welcoming that I felt, which is still really a hallmark of the shul and what it represents and how it has inspired many other shuls to carry on this vision throughout the throughout North America. When Daphne asked me to speak, I wanted to do something that I thought had some depth to it, but also was of a contemporary issue, and that is to deal with some of the issues of warfare. Unfortunately, we live at a time in which both as American citizens and as citizens of the State of Israel, whether formally or just accidentally, is something that we need to deal with. And I wanted to go through really a certain philosophical idea behind the notion of warfare as it's seen within the texts of modern philosophers, modern ethicists, and also to then look at it from a mirror image, from a perspective of Jewish law. So without any further ado, we're not going to do all 21 pages of this handout, but we're going to do some of them. And the pages and the sources are there for you to ponder, should you wish, afterwards. So let's open this up. First of all, just for those of you who are still formal students, I want to introduce you to a very important resource called the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. How many of you have used the Stanford? Okay, only one or two, so that's an important source. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is a wonderful online, rigorous, which is normally an oxymoron, an online rigorous encyclopedia on philosophy in general. Anytime that you are doing a paper on an issue and you want to get a little overview of the topic, you should go to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. It is constantly updated. It gives you great sources, and as in most scholarly work, the footnotes are probably more important than the text itself. And this is, it's just a wonderful piece. So I would suggest that you use it should you have to write reports that have a philosophical component to it. And I actually even gave you the path. But if you just Google Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, it'll get you right there. So I wanted to focus on the notion of the ethics of war. And I literally copied from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy the notion of the ethics of war and inserted in there, as you'll see in blue boxes, summaries that I put together on Michael Walzer's piece called Just and Unjust Wars. You cannot study the notion of warfare in a contemporary period of time without studying Michael Walzer. He runs a think tank in Princeton. He's spoken at YU at least once or twice in the past year. He's really the guru on notions of warfare. Sometimes he writes on Jewish issues of warfare. There, he's not as much a guru as he'd like to think he is on the topic, and many, including Professor Ravitsky and others, have taken him to task on it. And by the way, one of the reasons why he's not such an expert on Jewish warfare, and it's an article that, please God, should I ever have the time to finish, I will publish, is that the fact that he only looks at Jewish sources in their secondary, in a secondary fashion. He doesn't read Hebrew. So you can't be holding in an issue in great depth if you can't read the text in the original. It's like reading Shakespeare in a translation. In other words, it just doesn't work. In other words, it just doesn't rhyme. It doesn't move. It doesn't flow. You can't just read Rambam from the translation that someone did. You can't read primary sources, not in the original, and understand what they're talking about. And a little St. Thomas Aquinas, which is important because he's really the father of all issues of just warfare. And then we will get to halakha and look at the Rambam and others on the issue. What is tragically but exciting on the issue at the same time is that from a Jewish perspective, warfare was something that for the past 2,000 years, it's not that we were not victims of warfare, but we were never ones that orchestrated or were involved in defending ourselves as a community, as a country. Warfare was relegated to theory. The Baalei Mussar, correctly so, would use the psukim in the Torah that dealt with warfare, and they would change their context to focus on your own personal wars. So look at all the Kabbalists, and they'll speak about your enemies are really the demons inside you. And it goes through the whole Eisha Shifas Toar, and we'll turn it in a way that has a relevance to, at that time, was a contemporary situation. And only recently have the bookshelves been filled with a contemporary lens of how to deal with halakha and the notion of warfare. So let's look at this notion of justice, human rights, and morality, the ethics of warfare. So if we turn to the first page of the handout, I underline the piece that's important, and that is the core and controversial proposition of just war theory is that sometimes states can have the moral justification for resorting to armed force. War is sometimes, but of course not all times, it's probably not even most of the time, morally right. The idea here is not that war in question is merely politically shrewd or prudent, or bold and daring, but fully moral. And the example of a moral war would be World War II, the Allies fighting Germany, etc. Now, it's important to recognize that just war theory has a pedigree of personalities that have really articulated it, whether it's Augustine or Aquinas, or as I mentioned, more contemporary theorists like Michael Walzer, who have focused on this. There's been other theories. There's a theory called just peace theory, which is developed by a group of Episcopalians who say that there's never a time for war. One of the esteemed leaders of that group, who was a former president of the Auburn Theological Seminary, and I once had a conversation in front of divinity students on this. And in my conversation with him, the point I made was, it's nice to be able to have this theory that you never need to go to war, but the theory's been around for 35 years, and to the best of my knowledge, the Episcopalians haven't needed to fight a war. So it's a nice theory, but unfortunately doesn't always have relevance. But St. Thomas Aquinas, who has an unbelievable, his piece, which if you turn to page 2 in the box, highlights that in order for war to be just, there needs to be really three things. First is that there's a sovereign authority that commands that war should be waged. It cannot be the business of a private individual to declare war because the individual seeks to redress any rights. That's number one. Second, a just cause is required. Namely, those who are attacked should be attacked because they deserve it on account of some fault. And third, this last paragraph, it is necessary that the belligerents should have a rightful intention so that they intend the advancement of good or the avoidance of evil. There has to be a goal, and the goal has to be not a guaranteed avoidance of evil, but an attempt to deal with the issues and the challenges thereof. Michael Walzer, in discussing the notion of just warfare, points out that there are two notions. There is what we would call just cause and the way you conduct war. There are zwei dinim, to use a Brisker terminology. There's two different components to the meta-narrative of what just warfare is. The first is the notion of just cause. Turn to page 3. There has to be a state may launch a war only for the right reason, and the just cause most frequently mentioned includes self-defense from external attack, from defense of others, the defense of others from such, the protection of innocence from brutal, aggressive regimes, the punishment for a grievous wrongdoing which remains uncorrected. In other words, most of the time, a country can only protect itself from an external enemy attacking it, but there are some times in which a country loses its status as being a sovereign authority when it doesn't respect the rights of its citizens. For example, when citizens are enslaved, when citizens are being abused, then even a foreign government can come in a just way, not to acquire its territory or anything of that nature, but rather to be able to protect citizens that are being compromised even by their own government. Turn to the next page. Michael Walzer, and that's in the box, and I those in brackets, those are the page numbers where these quotes come from. When human rights are being violated in a state, as in the case of enslavement or massacre, it makes talk of a community, the right of the state, or the self-determination of the state seem cynical and irrelevant. Humanitarian intervention is justified when it is a response to the acts that shock the moral conscience of mankind. War may never achieve absolutes. It may never achieve complete territorial integrity, total invulnerability, or everlasting peace. The object of war is a better state of peace, and better within the confines of the argument for justice means more secure than the status quo. In order for a soldier or civilian not to have died in vain, war must be just. A purpose that is worth dying for. A purpose that is morally urgent may include political independence, communal liberty, or the protection of human life. And while working to deter war is admirable, appeasement is not to be argued if by so doing injustice and aggression will triumph. I would say Chamberlain versus Churchill, right? That sometimes appeasement can create a greater evil, as we've seen in history. And if we turn to the next page, you'll see a larger, you know, this idea being developed a little bit more. We don't have the time to develop it a little bit more. Page 5, page 6. I want to go to just and bellow, and that is the second din in war. And that is not only that there has to be a just cause, but there has to be responsibility in the way war is fought. So let me give you an example which is not found here. When the North invaded the South in order to deal with issues like slavery, they may have had a just cause, but sometimes the war was fought in an unjust way. For example, the burning of the city of Atlanta, right? That was an unjust way of trying to achieve a very noble cause. And by the way, people in Atlanta have still not forgotten that, okay? And it's important just to recognize that. There's two dinim here. There's two laws here. There's two components. You have to fight the war in an appropriate way also. It can't just be that once you have a just reason, you can just do whatever you want. there has to be, according to secular philosophers and modern philosophers, there has to be an appropriate component to it. And if you turn to the next page of our handout, page 7, as you'll see that my goal here was not to read every page of the 21 pages, but just to give you, it mentions obey all international laws, discrimination and non-combatant immunity, proportionality, and I want to read what Walzer writes, at least in the box, at least the first paragraph. There are times when a non-combatant's life can be put in harm's way. If combatants are living in a area where non-combatants are, so that creates a situation where you might sometimes have to destroy, Rahmana Litzlan, non-combatants. Walzer writes a piece during the last war in the Gaza, how Israel was forced at times to deal with issues, and even if it meant tragically at times that it killed non-combatants, even though it tried not to, but if a hospital becomes the base of an army, it loses its status of being a place of non-combatants. For Walzer, the killing of the non-combatant can never be the goal of a military operation, but rather the tragic, evil consequence. Such activity, the loss of civilian life, is permitted in a war when the following four prerequisites hold true. The operation itself is good and a legitimate act of war. The direct effect is morally acceptable, namely the disruption of military supplies or the killing of enemy soldiers. The intention of the soldier is good. He aims only at the acceptable effect and seeks to minimize any evil consequences. The good effect is sufficiently important to compensate for the evil consequence. And he develops this more, and I'm just picking up, you know, snapshots, sound bites on these issues. And this issue is highlighted more, how we benevolent quarantine of prisoners of war, etc., etc., etc. That's found on page 8. So let's turn to page 9, which is now the conversation about how halakha dealt with these issues. And my purpose of creating this contemporary backdrop is to show you that way before Michael Walzer, or for that matter, Augustine or others, that these two dinim in war, namely that it has to be a just cause and there has to be an appropriate way that the issue is being dealt with, these two laws were part and parcel of the consciousness of halacha and have always been part of the consciousness of halacha. And it's interesting to note. Now, there isn't a plethora of sources, because, again, as I explained to you, that the sources that we have that are new are only 60 years old, and within within the notion of halacha, that's just a blink of an eye. But what's important for us to recognize is that there are sources that stem from the Rambam, as well, you know, based on conversations or based on ideas that are found in the Torah. So let's turn to page 10 for a second. What is, by the way, I did this for two reasons, and I'm focusing more on the students. I think some of you, Daphne had arranged as part of the conversations that we had in GPATS and in other places, that we talked about the whole notion about how you create text for a class and the need for sometimes introductory materials. So not everything, you know who the Rambam is, you know who most of the personalities are here that I'll mention, that it's important in the context of a class that sometimes we also mention who the personalities are to give the historical perspective for the person at the class so that they can, you know, use this and put the sources in appropriate context. So let's look at the Rambam. The Rambam writes the following. Who wants to read the Rambam? Let's read the first halakha of the Rambam. Perek Aleph, halakha Aleph. Who wants to read? Aleph and Bet. Who wants to read? I'm calling you guys, but page 10. Page 10. Perikay. Halacha. Right, let's stop there. Translate. All right.
If it's a Muhammad Mitzvah. And what is considered a Muhammad Mitzvah? This is a war with the seven nations, or with a war with Amalek, and helping or saving Israel from an enemy.
Right, an enemy that attacks it. Go on. Ba'achar kach.
Ba'achar kach nalcham b'machane harishut. V'hi ha'machana sh'nalcham im shan ha'arim k'zei l'archiv k'vo Yisrael u'l'harbot k'zulato v'shama.
And then there can be the notion of what we would call an optional war, which can be fought with other nations for a host of different reasons. But let's go on further. Melchemet mitzvah. Want to read the next line? That's the line, so you want to pass it off to someone else?
I don't mind.
Okay. We'll call on someone to reach the next paragraph. Go on.
Melchemet mitzvah eno tzarich mitzol barishut bitin. Ela yotze me'atzmo kokoi. V'kofa ha'am lati. Ava melchemet harishut eno mutzi ha'am ba. Ela al pi bitin shal shivim v'chal.
Okay. So what does the Rambam say here?
For Machane Mitzvah, he doesn't need the permission of the Beitin.
Okay.
And he can just say, we're going to war, and
right,
force the nation to go also. But for an optional war, you can't force the nation, and you can only start the war with the permission of a Beitin of 71 people.
Okay. Parak Vav, who wants to read? Please. What's the Rambam saying here? Please.
That you don't make war with somebody until you offer them peace. And that applies both to Mechamet Rishut and to Mechamet Mitzvah.
That means the Rambam's writing that even a war against Amalek, you're not allowed to wage the war unless you've asked them to create some peaceful means in which they would live in the nation in Israel. This Rambam is a unbelievable Rambam. I don't think most of us are aware of this Rambam. We're always taught that Amalek, you know, come hell or high water, you kill Amalek and that's it. But it doesn't seem to the Rambam, it doesn't seem to be like that. If you look at the Nosei Kalim on the Rambam, which you can do at your, on your own, you'll notice that they all ask questions on the Rambam. But the Rambam is ironclad. He clearly states that you cannot fight. War is a last resort. It's a last resort in all cases. That not once in the Torah, when the Torah writes that you should destroy Amalek, does it not mean that you shouldn't try to find a peaceful way? Now, one could argue that the Rambam is imposing his philosophical vision even on the words of the text. One could read the text and not look at it through the way the Rambam does. And that personally, I get excited about that, because what I see happening by the Rambam is that the Rambam is trying to make sure that as Torah is v'chol netivotah shalom, the Torah represents the capacity for us to engage in society, that we have to be careful that we understand that the text is read in a certain way. There's a Torah Shebal Peh, and there's a Torah Shebiksav, and then we have to understand that you cannot read the Torah without understanding the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition. This is the oral tradition. There's no such thing as any war that can be fought if we don't try to create a peaceful way. A peaceful way would mean that the Amalek would agree to live in Israel and observing the seven laws of the Ger Toshav, which does not mean that they need to be observant Jews. It just means that they need to have the seven Noahide laws in part and parcel of their context for life. I find that to be, you know, extremely, extremely, extremely interesting to see. And if you look, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, Rav Chaim David Halevi, in Torah Shebal Peh, which is a wonderful journal to look at, in the 13th volume writes, in Hebrew, but I translated it here, the court would examine in a fundamental way the king's request for authority to go to war to determine if it were justified and what degree of risk it entailed, and in accordance with assessment, it would or would not grant his request. The whole idea that there be some type of checks and balances when it comes to war. And Professor Ravitsky would go on, moreover, this may be the very reason for requiring the king to obtain the Sanhedrin's consent before going to war, a requirement that makes waging war the joint endeavor of the political and judicial branches of government. Given that view of things, it becomes especially pertinent to ask why the king, whose power is great, should be required to consult the high court. The answer is, for the reasons we just talked about, and that is that we need to make sure that there's righteous justice, and not just the capacity to wage war anytime one wants. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually goes one up on the Rambam and says that he does not agree with the Rambam on the following issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva, where Rav Moshe Feinstein, and this is an important thing to understand because it really separates the role of a posek in America versus the role of a posek in Israel. He starts out his thing and says, listen, I normally answer shaylos of Isser v'Heter. I have questions about dishes, about silverware, and things of that nature. I answer those questions. I answer questions of the individual, but I don't normally answer questions on issues to deal with the national movement of our people. And that's really what Gullis is about. We have a conference coming up on Thursday called Champions Gate. There's around 260 people coming together in Orlando during the hottest time of the year in Orlando and having a conversation about certain issues. So one of the people we've invited is Rav David Stav, who is the head of Tzohar. And we've become pretty good friends in the work that we've been doing together. And one of the reasons why it's important for him to be there is because Rav David Stav, he and Tzohar look at issues from a totally different perspective because they're not just making decisions for a traditional community. They're making decisions for Am Yisrael in a greater context because there isn't the same bifurcation between religion and state. Sometimes that's a good thing, and a lot of times that's not such a good thing. So that's not our point of our conversation today. But Rav Moshe writes that very interesting introduction, but then he says the following. Ma'ashani sover, she'inyan milchama, the laws of war, even she'nogeh v'kuach nefesh, since they have to deal with the issue of risking one's life, tzarech tzivui miyuchad v'urim v'tumim v'sanhedrin, that you need Sanhedrin and you need the urim v'tumim, af b'mechemes mitzvah, even with the Mechemes Mitzvah. The Rambam, who said you don't need permission from Beis Din, Rav Moshe disagrees. He says, when it comes to Amalek, and that's why David and Shlomo never fought Amalek, because they never got permission of Sanhedrin, v'zeh davar barur muchrach, shelo shayach uflogav zeh. This is not normally Rav Moshe. It's so obvious that this is the thing, that you cannot fight wars. There's no such thing as a just war that a king can fight, except in a case in which the Jewish people have been attacked or are about to be attacked. And it's a preemptive strike to protect the people from being attacked. That's the only time you don't need the permission of the Sanhedrin. That is the only just war. That's what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes. So Rav Moshe Feinstein actually takes the Rambam, who says that you have to ask for shalom when it comes to Amalek and everything like that, and he one-ups it. And he says that the issue when it comes to Amalek, or when it comes to other milchamot, with the exception of a defensive war, they all require that balance between the power of the king and the prudence of the Sanhedrin. That's the first piece. So what is the Jewish concept of just war? And that is that the notion of just war is quite limited. Judaism does not have this ability for just to go out there and fight wars. According to the Rambam, it represents the idea that minimally it has to be that there's only three wars that are Mechemes Mitzvah. And those wars you have to try to live in peace beforehand. But you don't have to ask the Sanhedrin. But according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says, if Shah Ruflogel, so you can't argue. And it's not that he didn't know the Rambam. He says that there's only one war that you don't ask Sanhedrin for, and that war is the war of, a defensive war. What about the way we conduct ourselves in war? The second component of warfare. How do we deal with those? And let's look. So again, there isn't a large corpus of literature from thousands of years that deal with this issue. You have to extract from certain places. So for example, well, before I go any further, anyone have any questions on what we've done till now? Yes?
Why are we assuming that Shaylat Sanhedrin goes to the question of whether there's just cause rather than a question of just contact during war?
Because just contact would only be when the war has begun. Just war is whether you should wage the war or not. Just conduct is once the war has begun, how do you wage it?
Right, but it seems like just because you ask
right, but we trust the Sanhedrin more than we trust the king to make sure that there's prudence in that peace. Our concern is that if we leave all the power in the power of one individual who has the right to seize property and things of that nature, that what will happen is you'll have a situation where the king will become so interested in perhaps growing his power base that he will not be prudent in how he uses warfare. And therefore, it is important for us to make sure there's a checks and balances. And using a court of 71 people or so is a court that can just make sure that there's the appropriate checks and balances. Okay? I mean, Rabbi Soloveitchik once explained that, you know, David HaMelech isn't able to build the Beis HaMikdash because, everyone says, because he spilt a lot of blood. But if you look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu's conversation with David HaMelech, he never says that. If you look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu's conversation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Ki yimlu yomecha v'shachaftem avosecha, your days have passed, you'll have to sleep with your parents, in other words, you'll pass away, and then afterwards your children will build the Beis HaMikdash. And then when David HaMelech has a conversation with Shlomo at the end of his life, he says that I spilled too much blood. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, well, how do you understand those two things? So he explained, and it's a Gemara in Gittin, in the first parak, Tosvos, and as well as a Sifri in Devarim, I think. And that is that David HaMelech had no right to capture outside countries like Syria and things of that nature before capturing parts of Israel. And because of that, it wasn't that he was involved in wars that were permitted. That would not have that would not have stopped him from building the Beis HaMikdash. It's when he got involved in wars that he had no right to fight that that's what compromised him. He was so involved with wars, he didn't know where to stop. He didn't know how to stop. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a personal conversation, which I will not repeat the details because it's being taped, gave examples of people that he felt throughout history didn't understand the responsibility of being prudent when fighting wars and perhaps took wars too far. And therefore, that's the point where your hands are dripping with blood, so to say, and you don't understand, you don't have those proper checks and balances. And the Tosfos in Gittin highlights the idea that in Syria, the whole notion of Trumot HaMasrot and everything like that, it's a kibush yachin, not a kibush rabin. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained that's all part of this larger context because David HaMelech didn't have a right to capture those lands because he didn't follow the military protocols. And that's what God is telling him. Your time was up. You were supposed to build it. Ki yimlu yamecha. Your days have passed. And David HaMelech tells his son, Shlomo, I just want you to know, my problem was that I fought the wrong wars. And that's why my hands are filled with blood. That's why I can't build the Beis HaMikdash. Turn to the next page, we'll talk about just conduct. Just conduct, rights of civilians. So you have an interesting case. So the Pasuk says, so is everyone with me so far, right? Everyone's good? So the Pasuk says, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od, the Yaakov is very frightened, and he separates his people into two parts, Vayachat Sisa'am Asher Ito, separates his people, and Rashi is concerned about the double language, Vayira, Vayitzar. And he's quotes from Medrash, Vayira, he's afraid lest he be killed, and he's distressed lest he may kill others. So the Maharal asks the question, turn to the next page. The Maharal asks, you know, why should he be concerned that he is going to kill somebody? After all, they are pursuing him, Esav is pursuing him, Hashkem lahargecha, someone haba lahargecha, someone comes to kill you, you're allowed to respond with brutal force. So if you look at the right-hand column, the last three lines on the right-hand column, from the second to last word, the Efshar Lomar, the Shema, that Yaakov was afraid, the Shema lo ba'u laharoget Yaakov, that maybe not all of the group came, of Esav's group came to, his band came to kill him. Afagav, the Esav Heviu Otamimo, even though last time I gave class from this pulpit here, I did not have to put my glasses up and down. Afagav the Esav Heviu Otamimo, even though Esav brought him, Mishum Hayira Ba'u, they came because they were frightened of him. In other words, the idea that Yaakov was afraid of was concerned that maybe he would kill people in defense of himself that weren't enemy combatants, that they maybe he had a right to kill them because they were with enemy combatants, but he was distressed about the fact that he might kill civilians. It might be justified that he kills them. If you're hanging around with the wrong people, sometimes you're going to get burned. But the bottom line is that could be the issue. The Rambam, quoting, using a pasuk in the Torah, highlights another thing, and that is when there's a siege on the city for the purpose of capture, it may not be surrounded on all four sides. You have to have one side open. Why? In order that you leave the opportunity for non-combatants, and I would say even sometimes enemies, to depart. I always thought that when the Israeli army in the last war had the phone numbers and called thousands of people in Gaza, tens of thousands of people in Gaza, and dropped leaflets to let them know that the army was coming, that was actually celebrating this Rambam. That the idea was that you have to leave an opportunity for them to leave. You have to create that opportunity. You have to create a way in which they are informed beforehand, even if it does, you know, create a compromised position. Which I think is important to recognize. It's not, and this is the tension that you'll find within in the literature right now. Where does the responsibility to let enemies know that you're fighting a just war, where does that end? Because every time you do that, you put your own soldiers at risk also. But at the same time, you have to make sure you don't put the soul of your soldiers at risk. Rabbi Stav, again, in the conversation I had with him, he was telling me about a shaila that he got that was text to him from the war, that he's a Rosh Hashiva in Petach Tikva, one of the Hesder Yeshivas. And the question was that they were up all night and they had to do Shemirah, and they were hungry and they were going to fall asleep. So there were strawberries, and they wanted to eat from the strawberries, but they realized there was gazela. Taking the strawberries. The strawberries are owned by citizens of the Gaza. They're not theirs. Pulling the strawberry and eating it is gzela. But at the same time, that they would starve. So they didn't know what to do. So they texted him, the shaila, and in the middle of the night, he responded that it's permitted for them to eat the strawberries to stay awake, but they can't even eat one more strawberry than they need to stay awake, because that would be the isur gzela. That is what we should be proud of. It's the challenge, and not that we haven't unfortunately been compromised by war in a spiritual perspective also, but it's important for us to recognize that is what the whole notion of warfare from the prism of Jewish law is about, and that is living it within a certain context. With this in mind, I want to just highlight to you again something that always bothered me.
I think that's putting a gloss on war to think that. That story bothers me.
Okay.
I mean, part of me thinks like, why would the Israeli army give enough food to these guys? Does Rabbi Stav really feel that? I know he's trying to make them feel better, but the bottom line is they're going to eat it. If they wouldn't have called them, would they have eaten it?
I think they wouldn't have eaten it, but I think they wouldn't have eaten it. I think they wouldn't have eaten it. But the bottom line is, I'm not trying to put a gloss on it. I'm actually trying to create a context where I think that in warfare, that there are many occasions in which what defines the character of the personalities is how you act in adverse situations, and I would never want to be in that situation, and I pray that people's children will not have to be in that situation. But I think there's a certain recognition of the fact that we need to make sure that we understand that Judaism's understanding of warfare requires us to respond when we're under attack. It's not we don't believe in a just peace thing, that we ignore warfare, we ignore war. But at the same time, we have to understand the capacity to go to war has to be thought out, and we also have to understand, as we'll see even more, that there's a certain sensitivity that we have to bring even to combatants, and that is an important idea. That sometimes when you're in war, And it's such a horrific thing. There's nothing worse than that, that we lose our sensitivity as individuals. And I think there is a challenge. It's not by coincidence that in the middle of the laws of warfare in Sefer Devarim is the conversation about a homicide in which we are not aware of who did that murder, and the process of finding out, you know, who did the murder. Crime Stoppers, a Crime Stoppers type of protocol. And I don't think it's by coincidence that it's sandwiched in the middle of the laws of war, because I think there's a certain, the juxtaposition is there to remind us that sometimes in war, we lose the identity, we lose the pain of the individual, we lose the character of the individual. I think that's true in Eicha also. The third parak of Eicha, right? It's the third parak of Eicha, has Ani Hageva Ra'a Ani. It's about the individual plight. And that has three times more psukim than any other thing. And actually, in the right venues, and Lincoln Square reads it in the right context, that parak is read differently than the other parakim to accentuate the idea that when you speak about the loss of millions of people, sometimes you forget about the individual. Sometimes we forget about the individual in the process. And therefore, in the middle of Eicha, sandwiched in the middle, is the recognition of what happens to the individual. And I think that sensitivity is what David Stav is trying to teach his students, that you have to be careful about eating an extra strawberry, even in a thing. It might look like a simplistic thing, but I think the message that it gets for them is, I think it's a very important message. Yeah, please.
I understand what you're saying, but if they are in fact in Gaza doing what they have to do to protect Israeli citizens, the means always doesn't justify the ends, but you have to stay alive to protect your country and your people and to fulfill your military duty.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I was not using that as a proof text. I was just showing you, I think, a sensitivity that I hope resonates. Sometimes you get concerned about the fact that people who have had to go to war for so long lose that sensitivity.
I understand.
And I think the challenge that we as a people have to have is never to lose that sensitivity. And again, it's easy for me to speak from the comforts of New York City, which is really inappropriate. But I think that the sensitivity that you see in that case, I think, speaks about, I think, if there is such a thing as beauty in warfare, which there's probably not, but the sensitivity in warfare.
I understand. Thank you.
Now, I wanted to show you another interesting thing that I found also. It's highlighting the responsibility that we have not to be soft, but to be responsible. Look at the Rambam when it comes to the laws of a city of idol worship. We're all familiar with the Psukim and Devarim that tell us that if there's a city that worships idols, the responsibility to destroy the city, kill everybody, Anashim, Nashim, Vataf, men, women, and children, just kill everybody. So look at the Rambam, how he puts it in the context, on page 14. Eich din irani dacha. What are the laws of an irani dacha? In the time in which, you'll excuse me, because we're getting to the end of our time, and I want to just say a few things. I'm just going to paraphrase this. When you have to create a city that's an irani dacha, the Beit Din HaGadol sends people to investigate if this is truly a city of idolatrous practices. And then, if there is proof that the vast majority of the city is involved in idolatrous practices, you then send two wise Talmidei Chachamim to remind them of their responsibilities and that to do tshuva. And if that doesn't work, then you surround the city, and before you do any destroying of the city or anything else like that, every single one of the people that live in that city needs to be brought in front of a Beit Din to evaluate whether that person has been involved in idol worship or not. Every single person. So it's an interesting thing. It's not so simplistic that you just go and kill the city. I mean, it's one of these cases that can't really happen. The protocols of that necessitate the killing of a city of idol worshippers is so vast. You have to go and warn them. Then you have to siege them. After you siege them, then you have to create a court. There has to be two aidim that see that every single person has done it. to aid him, I mean, the idea of getting to aid him to see anything is such a process. The process is so exhaustive that it's like the Ben Sora Mora case. It's a little Hayav, a little Nivra. It's not a possibility that the protocols that the Rambam puts here could ever have happened. And again, it's highlighting the idea that we are not fast in war to use warfare. That sometimes laws in the Torah are not there to be acted upon, but to create a context of showing how concerned we are for certain acts. And even this, if you look at the Ramah, one of the Rishonim, he's very concerned. He says, after you find that the vast majority of the city has been involved in warfare, and you've done it by interviewing every single member with two things, that you have a right to kill men, women, and children. So the Ramah says, Va'od t'mi'ali, d'ka'amar makin et kol hanataf, v'kol nashim l'fi charev, that you would suggest that once you went through this whole process, even if it didn't happen, that you would kill the women by sword and the children by sword. Hani nashim hechidamu. What are we talking about here? Iv de avdi avodah zarah, if they were involved in the avodah zarah, so they're no different than the men. V'ilo avdi avodah zarah, if the women weren't involved in idol worship, amai neharikin, why could you kill them? But to u the kamar makin et kol ataf, and you're saying that we should kill all the women, all the children. V'chalila, look at the language. V'chalila la'el mirasha, v'chihechan matzinu katan chayiv shezeh chayiv. Woe is it that we would ever have a God that would allow such an evil thing to happen. Woe is it that we would ever have a God that would allow such an evil thing to happen. My point again being that there is this idea that you can't just go to war and just destroy a city's population. The protocols are so... And in the Torah it says you kill Nashim Vataf. But the Ramah, knowing that, knowing what the Torah says, still says, hey, it's not so simple that that could happen, because God would never be so wicked or create such a wicked protocol that would allow something like that to happen.
Then why wasn't that highlighted in
the Torah? I think there's two pieces I want to mention that I'm trying to highlight here. The first mention is that you can't look at the Torah without looking at the Masorah. I think that that's the first piece. The second piece is that I think that what you're seeing Rishonim do is struggle with the context of the Torah to make sure that we understand that the Masorah would never allow us to basically go to war in a fashion that is not concerned with the lives of every human being, Jew or Gentile. I think that's what you're seeing here. You're seeing this response by significant personalities. This is not, these are significant personalities, making these statements. This is the Rambam saying that a Amalek requires shalom beforehand. It's Rav Moshe Feinstein saying that they need Sanhedrin. It's the Rambam again saying that the story in the Torah about Avodah Zarah requires a protocol that's so sophisticated that it's really impossible for it to happen. And then you pile on there the Ramah, who says that even if the Rambam's work, how could you ever suggest that a tav should be killed for something his parent did? Or a woman should be killed for something her husband did? Or a husband should be killed for something a woman did? Yes?
How does the Ramah you explain Muhammad Agag and Shmuel?
Muhammad.
Sha'al.
Right, so there's a lot of literature on how he deals with that, or how does Rav Moshe Feinstein explain it, or how does other people explain it. So, there are conversations about that. Some explain that that wasn't, some will explain that Sha'ul's mistake was not, was that once he engaged in warfare, he should have done the full thing. But his problem was not that he didn't engage in warfare. His problem was that he used warfare in a corrupt way, and the proof is the way he still took property and things of that nature. I'm not fully prepared to elaborate on that, but there is a lot of literature discussing how you work that out within this lens, and it's important. If you want, you send me an email, and I'll just give you more makorah for that. Let me just conclude with this page 16, and that is limited destruction, and this is straight from the Torah. The whole idea of we have to be careful when we're involved in warfare, not that chas v'shalom you put a person's life at risk and not cut down a tree or something of that nature, but there's certain ecological responsibilities certain components to the way you fight a war, in which we have to limit destruction, and we have to try to limit destruction in any way that we can. And then there's a letter from a soldier that I put together, as well as Michael Walzer's article in the New Republic that's talked about a more recent article from January 2009 that I thought was important reading for you on your own. But just to conclude, that we've been introduced in a very fast way. We've been introduced to the notion of warfare. We've looked at it from the lens of modern philosophers and ancient philosophers, and we've seen that there's really the major idea is that there's two components to warfare: the justice of the war and the way the war is fought. And then we looked at halakha, and we realized that that really is the way halakha has always viewed warfare. The war has to be just, and there's a struggle with defining which wars are just, and it's an important thing. And there's always a sensitivity of how the war is fought. And what I was trying to show with all of these cases was this: how much to an extreme that some Rishonim will go in order to articulate how careful we are in the way we fight a war and the sensitivity that we have to what can be called enemy combatants. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Yes, Charlie.
Yeah, but you know, when you fight a war, you win or you lose.
What?
If you fight a war, you win or you lose.
I think you have to, when you fight a war, you have to win on many different levels. You have to win on the most important level. On one level, you have to win from a tactical perspective, but on another level, you have to make sure that the souls of your soldiers are not compromised in the process also. Obviously, their lives are more important, but we have to be concerned for the souls also. Okay. Any questions?
Yes.
Yes.
We have another hour to go.
What?
Just 2 hours left.
Charlie, I'm here. Shimon and Lady, how do we put what? Why, dude? That's a very negative term.
Because we're
very
negative.
So Dom al Tavol Nafshi.
Yeah,
yeah. So and if you look, there are many people who are upset at there are many commentators who are upset that Yaakov is not forceful enough. And that's a challenge that Yaakov has a few times, thus the whole Yosef saga. Yaakov is not, you know, the quintessential. We learn good parenting things, and we learn such, and not, you know, we learn some challenges in parenting. The avos are not just there to teach it. We don't just learn from the strengths of the avos; we learn from their weaknesses also.
Right. That whole narrative, it seems like that's not like it just seems like that sort of is an exception. And in terms of like offering peace or things like that, like, I mean, it's very exceptional.
Thank you.
Right?
That what?
Like when the Kibbutzim like offer peace,
right,
and they accept that, like that seems to be a very like terrible part of the narrative. So it seems like that's an exception that they're not offering peace, that it's like very, very.
You see, the Rambam is pretty clear that he wants them to eat. It's prerequisite. Because it's not clear that people need to really honor the conditions of peace. That's what the issue
is. Is this the paper on the web?
I don't think so. It will be. The paper.
No. Is it the paper itself?
I can send it to you.
No. That's the itself. That's the way you spoke. This the itself.
I don't think so.
You didn't know.
I think everybody's.